I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
I am Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director at Gilead Sciences.
Welcome to Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will be speaking with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait.
Let's play a quick game of association. I'll give you a word and you think of an image that's related to that word. Ready? First word, icon. Did you think of your favorite celebrity? Next word, hero. Did you picture someone flying around in a cape trying to save the world? Last word, criminal. What comes to mind? A figure in a dark alley? Someone demanding money or threatening your life? Or possibly someone who looks like me? Maybe, but did you picture a regular person who could be living with HIV? The reality is that for people living with HIV, sex, consensual or not, can be a criminal act. Our guests today know exactly what that's about. I am Christopher Chauncey Watson.
And I'm David Malbranche. Welcome to another episode of Zero Hour, the global podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences. This podcast is intended to provide a space for open conversation about global perspectives on HIV, health, and health equity. Our first guest is Alexander McClelland. Alex is an assistant professor at the Institute of Criminology and Criminal Justice, Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. His work addresses the criminalization of HIV and the role of punishment in Canadian society, sexual autonomy, and surveillance. When did you first encounter the criminalization of HIV in your personal life?
I think it was when I've been living with HIV since I was 18 years old. And when I first tested positive, I started engaging with a community-based organization by and for young people living with HIV. And I was teaching, I would run workshops on sexual rights, sexual pleasure, how to have good sex as a person living with HIV, safer sex at the time, which was what we called it, because that was way back in the late 90s. And one of the people from our group, one of my friends, one of my peers from our group, got arrested for having consensual sex, oral sex with a guy who later found out he had HIV. He had practiced the same things that I had taught him in our peer support group. And I was actually called to potentially be a witness in his criminal trial. His case never went to trial, but that sent a shockwave through our whole community of young people living with HIV, and really opened my eyes and really scared the shit out of me, actually, and all our whole community and our group. Then I hadn't realized how that could even happen.
Right. And what does criminalization of HIV mean to you?
It is the manifestation of stigma. It is discrimination. It is another way to play out and target people who are considered not normal or other. It is a manifestation of racism and colonization. It is a way to control and surveil people who the mainstream group of people are scared of, queers, sex workers, migrants, people of color. And so I see it as just the demonstration and manifestation of stigma and fear.
You may have some listeners that are wondering why it's important for anyone listening to consider HIV criminalization. Why is it so important for all of us to consider this?
That happened to me very early on in my life, having that experience with my friend and who was very much impacted. He is still to this day has a very hard time with his life as a result of being criminalized. And I was just discovering my sexuality at that time. I was my late teens when I found out about that happening. And so I have never understood my sexual life outside of being policed or being surveilled or being scared of someone calling the police on me for having consensual sex with somebody that I love and am turned on by. And that should not happen to anybody. And having that criminal justice system invade every such a personal aspect of your life, that does so much to every positive person who lives in a context where criminalization exists.
What does it mean to have your sex life framed by the criminal justice system?
I mean, it means you're under surveillance. You're always concerned and scared. Like, I have friends who are completely paranoid about disclosure. So we'll take screenshots when they're chatting with guys. They will have about disclosure to prove that they disclosed. I have friends who have taken their partner to their doctor and disclosed in front of them so there's a record of someone else. Some people I know write contracts. We live in a context where you have to create an evidentiary trail about your sex life so you can potentially bring something forward in a court of law. And that's not an okay way to live. It's a constant state of paranoia, a constant state of being watched. And so it just impacts every aspect of people's life and leads to a lot of fear. Like, people aren't able to make helpful, informed decisions. People are scared to talk to their healthcare providers, share what they're actually doing and what kind of sex they're actually having, because they're worried that their nurse will end up on a stand testifying against them.
Yeah. Can you talk about the legal framework that makes HIV criminalization so extreme in Canada?
Around the world, there's a little over 80 countries who criminalize HIV in different ways. And some places, like in the U.S., you have HIV-specific laws. In Canada, we use general existing laws. And so nowhere in our criminal code does it say HIV anywhere. It's just how the law is interpreted and applied in a courtroom. We use aggravated sexual assault laws, which are one of the harshest charges in the criminal code, leads to a lifetime sentence, mandatory registration as a sex offender. And so that makes it a very challenging context. It is an existing law that needs to be there for a reason, but it's been interpreted to apply to HIV. So we often say in Canada, we don't have an HIV-specific law, but we have a default one.
Alex, help me understand, what is HIV criminalization?
HIV criminalization manifests in different ways, depending on where you are, and which country you live in. It can be criminalizing the act of potentially not telling your sex partner that you have HIV. It can be criminalizing transmission of HIV. It can be also criminalizing exposure of HIV. So that's has been used, like, if in a context of spitting or biting. HIV can be used as an aggravating factor in some criminal contexts. So there is some states in the U.S. that have aggravated prostitution laws or aggravated sex work laws, which will just heighten the punishment factor if you have HIV and are charged with that law. So there's transmission-related laws, there's exposure-related laws, and then there's HIV non-disclosure, the act of not telling someone else, or allegedly not telling someone else that you have HIV.
Because obviously criminalization means you're turning it into a crime. What are some of the penalties that people can face, either not disclosing or sharing their status for having certain types of sex?
Usually quite harsh penalties in relation to HIV. In Canada, it's a lifetime sentence, which is 25 years, and you can be registered as a sex offender. In other countries around the world, people can face lifetime sentences as well. And just generally quite harsh sentences comparable to murder or other very violent crimes.
What I'm hearing you really speak about is this global perspective of criminalization, and that it does look different in every country. Can you share some more stories from your backyard of Canada?
In Canada, I have done interviews with people living with HIV across the country who were prosecuted and criminalized, who are on the sex offender registry, who spent long time in jail or in prison because of what happened to them. And one of the women that I know, she was dating a man that he didn't know her HIV status. She had only recently found out that she was living with HIV. She was really depressed and upset and was partying a lot as a result because she didn't know how to deal with it. And so she was hooking up with this guy. She would party with him. And her way of disclosing to him was that she handed him a condom. She didn't know how to say, I have HIV. She probably had never said that to anyone. And she was also had a power differential with him. He was kind of controlling and aggressive. So she was scared of him. she handed him a condom. That was her way of disclosing. She was, I'm doing my due diligence. He didn't use the condom. And she is now a registered sex offender. She was in jail for 2.5 years. She was on the cover of the newspaper, and she was labeled a perpetrator who was trying to hurt him and harm him. She did her due diligence that she thought she could to protect herself and protect her partner. And she's framed as a violent perpetrator as a result.
How has U=U changed the situation in Canada?
Well, U=U is undetectable equals untransmissible, which for myself, as someone who's living with HIV, has been a very powerful thing to know that you can have the sex you want to have, and you don't have to perceive of yourself as being infectious or have people be scared of your body in the same way. It has been helpful in calling for science-based advocacy to change the laws, to ensure that laws are grounded in the current science of HIV, because a lot of these laws that exist, or the application of the laws, is grounded in stigma and discrimination and total misunderstandings of HIV, or really outdated understandings of HIV. But in Canada, we have what are called prosecutorial guidelines that have been implemented in some of the provinces, where prosecutors will no longer pursue a case if the person is virally uninfectious or not, or undetectable, which is really great. It's limited the scope of the law. But what that has also done is produced a context where there might be more intensified criminalization for people who aren't, who don't fit into the U=U category. And those are the most marginalized people in our society in Canada, people who are migrants without status, people who are recently released from prison, people who don't have a place to live. And so it's just could end up backfiring in a way, like so being really supportive, but also backfiring to target people who are already over-targeted by the law, who are already over-policed and over-surveilled.
When we talk about U=U, it's a very specific definition. So they want to make sure someone gets to undetectable, meaning a viral load less than 200 copies, stays that way for 6 months, and then that's defined as not being able to transmit HIV to someone who's HIV negative.
I really want to bring Robert Settle into this conversation. Robert is a recognized HIV racial justice leader and a leading international advocate who has dedicated his life to fighting HIV criminalization laws. He's also a founder of the Sero Project, which is a U.S.-based network of people living with HIV who advocate for the end of HIV criminalization. And he was also featured in a short film entitled HIV is Not a Crime. Robert, your life was forever changed by the criminalization laws here in the U.S.
Yes. I was diagnosed HIV positive in 2003, so it's 20 years of living with HIV. And I was enlisting to the military. It's actually how I found out about it. I never had any type of health, serious health issues growing up. So when I received a notification about, oh, you should come back, there's like this news, I couldn't imagine what it was going to be about. And so, like many people, you aren't automatically given the skills to negotiate how to disclose your status, let alone even tell a family member or a friend. But luckily, I was able to tell at least two friends, the guy that I was involved with at that time. He's not someone that was living with HIV or contracted HIV, thankfully. And so I just went on with my life to try to make some sense of it now that this is a part of my life. I was 2 months shy of graduating from college. And so I had plans, and I knew that I wanted to live and do what I needed to do concerning my health as well as my future. And so I would say, again, trying to go through life with disclosure of that as necessary. I tried to do that, and I've definitely gone through all the ups and downs that people go through around disclosing to different people. Different people respond differently to the issue of HIV, considering their relationship to it. And so you find out a lot about people, what they know and don't know about HIV by being someone disclosing it.
Can you tell either a story that was good when you shared your HIV status with someone, or maybe a story about something that didn't go so well?
Oh, wow. I can't explain a story that was good, but I can say one that did not go well, that has always stuck with me. The guy literally broke out into a cold sweat, and we hadn't done anything. We haven't even touched each other. And I just remember sitting there and sharing with him just because I wanted him to know. He couldn't say anything. He was shaking and almost crying that I met someone that I didn't know that well, just a casual relationship. Someone I met New Year's Eve going into the new year of 2008. And so we did go home together and we did, we were sexually intimate. And of course, it was consensual. Initially, we had decided not to have sex because we didn't have condoms. Of course, I was in care and receiving treatment at that time. But we did have sex anyway. And I felt I had disclosed what they're really focusing on is the fact that you're a person living with HIV. You've been identified as a person living with HIV. You are engaging in sexual activity and someone has accused you or is accusing you of exposing them to HIV. That is really all you need to be criminally liable. So over the 3 months that we were getting to know each other, my issue of my status never came back up until we broke up. And so as a result, I was threatened with being arrested. The guy that I was seeing eventually went to the police and pressed charges against me. It was never confirmed in court that he, in fact, contracted HIV or whether it was from me. Of course, the only thing that in this situation is that I've been identified as a person living with HIV. There's so much there that needs to be considered that is not considered in these cases. There needs to be like an assessment of, did I really intend to harm him? You know, was I in care? Was I receiving treatment? Were there condoms used or what steps that were taken to mitigate any risk or harm? And so none of that was considered. And so I went to court. I ended up losing my job and I ended up getting a probated sentence initially for 2 years, meaning I was given probation that I didn't have to go into prison. And what I did not know is when I went to register for probation at the probation office, I was told that I had to register as a sex offender. And in the state of Louisiana, it's a 15-year requirement, 15 years of having to be registered. And what that means when you do community notifications, that means they put your picture in the paper so that everyone in your city, and I live in a pretty large city, Shreveport, Louisiana, they send out community notification cards, which go out to everyone in your neighborhood within a certain radius. And so on that, they're not only saying what the offense was, which I was charged or convicted with intentional exposure to the AIDS virus, and also I had to pay to send those things out, to put the picture in the paper and pay for the notification card. So not only do they punish you, but they make you pay for it too. But keep in mind, I'm already a year and maybe a year and a half-ish into my 2-year probated sentence. And the court says, oh, yes, you do have to register, but you also have to go to prison. So my conviction actually required a minimum prison time. So I'm talking about state prison at hard labor. And so through this whole experience, it's been nothing but shock from the moment that I was diagnosed HIV positive, being convicted and now having to register as a sex offender and now having to go to prison. I took a plea. Of course, I didn't fight then because I didn't know everything that I know now, I didn't know then. And so you'd figure that you're doing the best that you can. And so you're kind of at the mercy of the court and the prosecutor, which is a very dangerous space to be in. And for me, it was my first offense ever. And so I definitely didn't know what to do. And so I took the plea because I wanted it to be over. Yeah, I'm going through it, but I have no one to tell me, oh, this is what's happening. This is HIV criminalization. And so I ended up doing 6 months in prison. But those 6 months, 180 days are days that I'll never get back. And considering all the things that I've lost in terms of my job and my earned income and my retirement, with the little retirement that I had, I had to use that to get an attorney. So it really took a lot from me. And it didn't matter that I had a degree. It didn't matter that I was, I didn't have any prior criminal record. It didn't matter if I was in care. Like none of those things were considered at all.
Do you think race played a factor in any of this process?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Here in the South, in America, where the epidemic is so prevalent, if you put the fact of how prevalent HIV is in the southern region of our country, and then you layer that with the states that have the HIV-specific laws, both maps would align. And so it creates this perfect storm for people who are Black, like me, Black and gay. We are very liable to face becoming HIV positive and then, of course, being criminalized because of our HIV status. So it just becomes another way to criminalize Black people.
What can we do in communities of color, Black, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, with regards to protecting from HIV criminalization?
We have to, I always say, people first need to know about HIV and how that impacts their lives. And then you need to learn about the criminalization of it. And most people are shocked by the fact that this happens. Just the education and becoming aware, like I can't stress that enough. I was someone that was unaware that they was at risk for HIV. I was someone who did not expect to be caught up in the criminal justice system, but here I am. And so I think had I known these things, I could have figured out a way to navigate through them or around them or so that I wouldn't become a statistic. Again, all it takes is an accusation, regardless of whether you are intending to harm, not intending to harm someone by the fact that you living as being a gay person living with HIV or even being a heterosexual living with HIV. You can face this type of experience and punishment. I want to caution people not to count themselves out that this can't happen to them. It can.
Can you talk a little bit about what is the Sero Project?
The Sero Project was an organization that I co-founded about a decade ago, 2012. I got out of prison in January of 2011. And so I immediately called the number that was on the blog and introduced myself to the guy that wrote it. We both co-founded the organization together. And so he introduced me to people who are part of this broader movement, or at least starting the movement around HIV decriminalization. So it's an organization that's led by people living with HIV. It's an organization that represented the people who've been impacted by HIV criminalization, such as myself. And so I was responsible for the education and outreach for the organization. I was a little concerned that many people wouldn't take us seriously because of the fact that here I am a convicted felon. And I'm grateful for the progress that we've made and the experiences that have really allow us to bring the awareness and the voices and experiences of people living with HIV who have faced criminalization.
What would you both tell a person either newly diagnosed or living with HIV for a little longer, what they need to know about HIV criminalization?
Robert just said it can happen to you. I agree with that. It can happen to anyone who has HIV. We're like always one jilted partner away from someone calling the cops on us. And but it does specifically target certain communities. Marginalized and racialized communities will be targeted more, as they are with the patterns of inequity that are run through the criminal justice system and policing in the first place. I want to build a world where people living with HIV are not scared and can have sexual autonomy and can live a fully realized sex life where they feel great about themselves and have awesome sex and are not scared of the police and the surveillance of the criminal justice system. But currently we are in that place.
How can we do that? Robert mentioned education. Are there any other ways that we can reach that where people aren't scared, where people can enjoy and have pleasure with the sex that they have while also living with HIV?
I think we have to encourage communities to have conversations about this. We have to encourage people not to call the police on each other. We have to talk openly about people's fears around HIV. We have to challenge popular representations of positive people or people on the down low lying to their partner. That's not stuff that happens for positive people. Positive people want to take care of their health. They want to take care of their sex lives. They want to act in a good faith in the world. And so I think we need to have positive representations as well and have conversations that are hard for people, like talk about people's fears and stigma and then diffuse them so that we can realize that there's a better way.
Robert, I'll come to you first. How has HIV criminalization, do you think, affected global prevention and or treatment efforts?
Well, I want to just say that the treatment works. So I feel like it should just sort of dissolve these criminalization laws, but that's not happening. We're spending so much money on prevention, but then we're also criminalizing people. So it's almost like we're going to do the work to prevent it, but yet we don't believe that prevention is really working. And so we're going to criminalize people. And so you can't do both. And if we want people to disclose their status, then we need to make it legally safe for them to do that. And unfortunately, in the U.S. and Canada and other parts of the world, it's not safe to do that. It's our elected officials, they seem to not really be paying attention to that. The public really needs to become aware now of all the advancements that have been made so that you don't have to live in fear anymore.
Alex, you, what any impact that you've seen these laws on advancing treatment and prevention?
I know people hide their HIV medication from the people they're sleeping with. They're scared to have their roommates see it. They're scared to have people know what their prescription is and that they're going to the doctor. They're scared to talk to their healthcare providers about their sex lives. And so that right there, it's like if we are scared of our medication or other people seeing it because we're worried about how that could be used in the context of a criminal justice system or stigma or discrimination towards us, that just creates an environment that isn't cool for anyone who has HIV. So, and that's created directly by these laws. You know, often we talk about stigma in HIV world, you know, stigma is an issue. Stigma is a result of these laws that are discrimination manifested. And the stigma isn't this like thing that just is out there. It's a result of consequence of criminalization. And in order to get rid of stigma, we have to get rid of criminalization so that people can like access healthcare in the way that they want to and feel autonomous about their lives. I have been dating with HIV my entire adult life. I had a boyfriend break up with me because he said, I don't want to date someone who I know is going to die. I was like, we all know that everyone's going to die, but that was his way of breaking up with me. I've had guys tell me that I'm, say slurs on me, to me on, dating apps, all kinds of shit. It happens all the time.
For me, the greatest manifestation of stigma has been just the criminalization experience. I mean, if I'm experiencing other forms of stigma, it's because I'm Black and gay, HIV positive, sex offender, and a convicted felon. So I carry quite a few labels, some that I am proud to share or carry, and others not so much.
What does HIV criminalization look like globally?
What I would like to emphasize is the fact that a lot of the countries that we do a lot of work in terms of prevention, I think about the women and girls in sub-Saharan Africa, who are most likely the population that are contracting and living with HIV. These same countries that have the high prevalence of HIV affecting certain populations, they also have the criminalization aspect. And so these women and girls are not safe because no one's looking at the fact of how they're contracting HIV. I am very concerned about them, not only contracting HIV, but just the threat of the criminalization laws in those countries.
Well, me and Robert both sit on the Global Advisory Panel for the HIV Justice Network, and they're a really amazing leading organization who have helped organize advocacy to counter HIV criminalization around the world. And they develop a hotspot map every year that shows you the different countries that are affected and the different places and different types of criminalization that exist. Criminalization is rooted in stigma. And so any stigma and discrimination that exists already, fears of the other, racism, homophobia, misogyny, sex work phobia, drug use phobia. So it's another way to criminalize people. It's like a layer upon a layer upon a layer of forms of criminalization. And generally with HIV, the way HIV criminalization manifests is just mirroring those other laws. It's another way to target people and control and regulate their sexualities and lives.
But what's the connection between HIV and sexual freedom for you?
Well, sexual freedom to me is the freedom to be able to express yourself sexually in any manner or forms that you want without fear, without repression or violence. And for people living with HIV, we've been told that we shouldn't be having sex. In fact, we have laws that promote preventing us from having sex. So to prevent people living with HIV or gay people or sex workers from having sex. And so I feel like people living with HIV should have the freedom to have babies, to have families, to have relationships, and to have sex in any form and manner that they want, especially now that we have prevention We have the medication. We have the tools that we need to protect ourselves.
Yeah, I think the same. I mean, it means not having fear in your life, being able to do the things that you want to do and feel pleasure and feel emancipated from fear and feel emancipated from surveillance and feel emancipated from external people who don't know shit about your life telling you how to run your life and what to do. That's what sexual freedom would mean to me.
Those are great. It's interesting. I was just, as you both were talking, I was just thinking this happens in medicine as well. But when people reach a certain age, we don't ask them about their sexual histories anymore. Like someone comes in who's over 60, mm-hmm. who's over 65, who's 70. Part of that medical history is not asking them about sex. And I see a similar dynamic with people living with HIV. We screen people for their sexual behaviors when they're those who would benefit from PrEP. But we don't always continue those sexual health conversations. What gives you pleasure? What feels good? Who do you love after someone gets HIV? Could either of you speak about that a little bit?
There's a inspirational woman living with HIV in Canada, Darian Taylor, who has said publicly that she stopped having sex just to manage her mental health. Because after learning she was HIV positive, just because she was so scared of being criminalized, so scared of the stigma. And that has just always stuck with me. She talks openly about how she just disconnected herself from accessing pleasure or realizing a sex life as a result of her diagnosis. And that's not uncommon. That's a normal outcome that happens when people are so scared of being criminalized or so scared of stigma. And that's just a shitty situation. It's a shame that that happens. And so, yeah, we need to have more of those conversations to kind of reconnect people living with HIV back to pleasure and back to feeling sexy and being able to have autonomy in their sex lives.
And I know this happens quite a bit in the gay community, especially for those that are newly diagnosed. We go through this phase of thinking that, oh, I'll never have sex again, or no one wants to have sex with me. And so even now, I am on social media and I see there are people who are choosing not to have sex with people who are or who identify as a person living with HIV, like on purpose. And we know that's rooted out of fear. And in 2023, this is where people's minds and thoughts are. People are whole beings. And we have to take that into consideration. And just because you are living with HIV doesn't mean that you have to suppress everything about you. You are a human being and you're supposed to have sex. you are created for that.
Why should people care that HIV be decriminalized?
Because it's a violation of human rights. It's a violation of dignity. It exacerbates the HIV epidemic and it leads to insecurity for people and communities.
I love Alex's answer in regards to the violation of persons' human rights, because that's really what it comes down to. Regardless of what's happening with people, their rights are valid. Their rights should always be taken into consideration. And this shows you just to what extent people's rights, human rights, are violated on a daily basis.
So, Alex, what would you say to people who feel that HIV criminalization laws are justified?
I talk about this issue all the time because I think it's important to get at what makes people think that it is justified. I often say that there's a lot of things we feel like we should know about people or want to know about people that we're having sex with. We may have a right or feel like we have a right to know certain things about people we're having sex with. We may want to know, for example, that the person we're having sex with is massively in debt, makes racist comments, doesn't have a good relationship with their family, has mental health issues, or many other things. And I'm not equating any of those to HIV. But I think it's important for us to think about, why is this one specific thing regulated so harshly by the criminal justice system and results in someone being incarcerated or arrested and incarcerated? Why do we feel justified to know this one specific thing, specifically in a context right now where there's no actual harm if someone's undetectable? So that's what I would say to people, or I try to have a conversation about, like, why do we feel justified to know and what are the consequences?
I've also experienced people that say it's not so much about HIV itself, like the sharing of HIV, but it's almost on a more intimate like trust level? Like, hey, I thought we were close. Why did you not feel you could tell me? When people don't understand the stigma that's attached with that and with sharing that information, the possible rejection that can happen, some people are often confused and they're like, well, why don't you just tell me? And I feel horrible now because, you know, you obviously didn't think high enough of me that you could tell me. One of the things that I find always fascinating, the argument that people have or the discussion they have is like, well, someone should tell me about their HIV status or share that with me. And other people will say, well, it's not up to me to share that with you because you're not sharing with me certain other details of your life. And then some people living with HIV are very clear that they share it from jump because they say, you know what? Somebody didn't afford me that opportunity. Because someone will say, well, if the person had told me they were living with HIV before, I would have made different decisions or I would have done something differently. There's always kind of this push or pull about judgment about who actually should have the right to say these things. And is it just fall on the responsibility of the person living with HIV when the person who's not living with HIV could be living with genital herpes and doesn't necessarily share that?
Yeah, the responsibility always ends up on the HIV positive person. And the outcome of HIV criminalization laws is that disclosing is just an easy thing that everyone should do, but people aren't provided the skills to do it. And in Canada, and the people living with HIV's mugshots are on the cover of newspapers because, and they are framed as violent perpetrators. And so there's a man who in Winnipeg, in the prairies in Canada, who disclosed his HIV status to a guy he met on Grindr. That guy came to his house afterwards and beat him 27 times with a golf club until he was dead. Mm. And that's the context of disclosing. Like that's the outcome of him disclosing. He was doing what he knew was right and what had been told to him. But the context of criminalization produced that as the outcome. So I also say that it's logical and rational and safe for an HIV positive person not to disclose, because that's the context that's produced as a result of criminalization. And why do people feel they have a right to know personal health information about somebody else that has no consequence on their life? And so why do people still feel they have an entitlement to knowing that stuff? And that is all grounded in outdated bullshit and stigma and fear.
I want to ask each of you one last question. What does ending the HIV epidemic look like for you?
I can see ending the HIV epidemic when HIV is no longer a crime.
It really is respecting people who are living with HIV. I really feel like there's a lot of lack of respect, and that there are people who feel like they can make decisions for people who are actually living. People who are not living with HIV feel like they can make decisions for people living with HIV. So I really want to emphasize respecting people living with HIV and respecting them as experts and respecting them as people who deserve to have their rights and not have their rights violated through the criminal system.
Well, I think that really wraps up today's conversation. So thank you both, Alex and Robert. After hearing from today's guests, I still go back to the question we asked at the beginning. What is a criminal? Is it theft? Is it murder? In too many parts of the world, what makes a criminal is having HIV or simply being a sexual minority. No one should lose their freedom because of they are living with HIV. In too many parts of the world, what makes a criminal is having HIV or simply being a sexual minority. No one should lose their freedom because they're living with HIV. HIV criminalization laws create a chill that stops people from accessing both HIV prevention and treatment services. These laws make it harder for people living with HIV to have open and honest conversations with their healthcare providers, as well as limits their ability to get the care that they need. Let's stand in solidarity until every one of these harmful and unscientific HIV criminalization laws are finally repealed.
I want to thank both of our guests, Alex McClellan and Robert Suttle, for joining us to talk about the work you are doing to shed light on the impacts of HIV criminalization. And those of you listening in, If you liked what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts and look for it on YouTube. For more information, please also visit GileadHIVTogether.com.
This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.